Good morning. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. I was saying this morning that I have my brother-in-law lives in Roslindale, in Boston, and I said, slightly different scenery here, and that's good. My talk today is entitled Conversations, Two Grand Pianos on a Stage, and if you're wondering why it makes absolutely no sense, I should warn you that there's this, little group of doctoral students back at Syracuse who every so often come in and they just sort of say, oh, not that title again. And so I've really taken up the challenge of random name assignments and seeing if I can make them logical in the presentation. So it's a challenge for me. I'd like to talk about how we can shift and think about library services. And it may, after this, the interesting remarks that just happened, why do we need to change? Things are going well. We need more money, but we got people coming in. We got resources coming in. We're doing just fine. And I would argue that, yes, that is great. But what's next? What's going to happen after that economy recovers and the people go back to Amazon or what have you? So I think it's always important for us to spend some time thinking about our future and thinking about why we do what we do. The two most important questions I think people need to ask in their libraries are why and why not. I think that we need to start just about every meeting with a why are we doing this? Why are we having this meeting? Again, why do we do this the way we do? Why do we do this service? Why do we do that? I was on the board of our local public library, and at one point the area of reference came up. We were sort of doing the introduce the library to the board members thing, and reference came in and talked a little bit about what they do. And this trustee put up his hand and said, so let me get this straight. I can ask you anything, right? And they said, yes. He said, and the county pays for this, right? Yes. Right? So the librarians were really happy. He clearly got it. And he said, so if I want to know how to get red wine stains out of a tablecloth, I can ask you that, right? And he said, sure. And then the trap was sprung. And why do tax dollars go to answering questions about people spilling wine? Now, it was very interesting because, at this point, that's when I jump up and say, and this is, we get them in and... But the librarians came to me after the meeting incensed that that question was asked. Incensed that they didn't get it. They, being the trustees and the people who control the budget, didn't get it. And I said, why? Are you incensed? Shouldn't we, on a regular basis, ask these questions about why we're doing them and why not? And if we can't defend the answer, should we continue to do them? Now, I happen to think, reference, we have a good story to tell. I'm not sure that can be said of everything. I mean, even down to, you're talking about document delivery services, loading things on a van 5 days a week to drive it around and such, and does this make sense? And what about roving collections, where literally if we send it out to a library, they keep it when it gets returned, and we looked at the shift of materials, which they've done up in Canada for a long time. Which leads to the second question, which is, why not? I mean, how many times have you been at that meeting where you have a grand idea, and that the historian of the committee, the historian of the committee, we should have a blog. Well, what you gotta remember, and you gotta, is in 1932 we tried blogging and it didn't work out. Really, 1932. It was with slate tablets. We hung them out front of the library and let people bring their own chalk. So why not? Why can't we do something radically different? Why can't we be more Barnes & Noble-like in how we arrange the books and materials? My favorite public library thing that we need to change today is when you have everything done by the Dewey Decimal System and everything is done by the numbers and the big signs above the stacks are the numbers, and then on the end caps are the poster that translates the numbers to English. Could this be backwards? Maybe we could start with English? Just a thought. All right. So why and why not? So let's talk about conversations and two grand pianos and figure out if this makes any sense. And so my task today, what I want to do over the next 45 minutes or so, is I want to answer this question. And for those of you who can't read because it's that tiny, let me read it for you. How students learning math in 1960s England leads to two grand pianos in a public library. Right? So that's my task, is to get from the starting point of Britain's learning math in the 60s to why we need to put 2 grand pianos into a public library. Now, that may sound like a very odd question and sort of a nonsensical one, but it comes actually from one of my favorite historians and broadcasters, a fellow by the name of James Burke. And James Burke hates how most people teach history. You know, when we learned history, it was, you know, in 1300 this happened, in 1305 this happened, in 13. Please memorize the following names by dates. I was an art student in college, and the great thing about being an art student in college is that we got the easy art history class, ironically. All the people out of arts and sciences had to memorize this painter on this day with this technique. We had to, like, know the concepts that were going on. It was much easier. Right? Anyway, but what Burke says is, history isn't just this sort of nice linear unfolding of predictable anticipation. History is a series of threads and interchanges and feedback loops. And so his example is how the North won the U.S. Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Right? So I've gotten this down to about a minute and a half. So let's see if I can do it. The South, by traditional military thinking of the time, should have won the U.S. Civil War because it had more manpower and could deliver more soldiers to the field. The idea is more soldiers to the field leads to victory. The interesting thing happened, though, is that the North, by luck and by resources, had more industry than the South. So while they couldn't muster more men to the field, they could create more artillery and cannons to the field. So what they did to equalize the numbers, they brought in artillery. The problem with cannons and guns is you can't just point them at someone and go bang and expect to get them. It's called a ballistic arc. It shoots in this trajectory. And the way you compute that distance, this angle, is calculus. Area under the arc. And not too many Civil War soldiers on either side could do calculus in their head on the fly while being shot at. So what the cannon manufacturers would do is they would cloister a bunch of mathematicians that they called computers into a room that would actually do all the calculations for you and create a table. It said, if the bad guy is 50 meters away, shoot at this angle and you'll kill them. And so now what they could do is they could bring and look at these tables. This shifted the idea of how one wins the war from manpower to artillery. This became the new common knowledge that went into World War I and World War II. The problem in World War II is that the U.S., for the first time, was facing a foe with greater industrial capacity than the U.S. itself. Germany knew how to build things and knew how to build them fast. And so it led to an arms race of more and more artillery of greater and greater magnitude and greater power, which led to the need for more and more of these charts and more of the computation, and we ran out of people. So what we sought to do was to automate the process, and so we created these things called ENIAC, which were digital computers to do the calculations for us. The problem with those initial computers is that they were run on vacuum tubes where electricity would go through that were very fragile. In fact, when insects walked into them, they would burst the vacuum tube, bring down the machine, which is why we use the term bugs when things break your computer. And so what they had to do was come up with a replacement for vacuum tubes, and they figured if you wafer two pieces of silicon together in just the right way, you get this thing called a transistor, which is great for low-level electrical activity. The thing about is also great about the transistors, you can shrink them smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to where you can get tens and hundreds and thousands and millions of these transistors onto a chip, which led to greater computing capacity, which led to the integrated circuit, which is the CPU of the modern computer. So therefore, the North winning the U.S. Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Woo! Thank you. It's not linear, right? It's not, and then this happened and this happened. You couldn't even say it's causal to a degree. And that it's an interesting way of looking at how we think, which is how we relate ideas together. So what I'd also like to point out is that as you look at this, if you were to take that same story and look at all the resources that inform that story, what book I read, what artifact happened, what interesting discussion was, and you were to catalog those resources, it would start to look really odd because what you would start is, well, we're talking about the Civil War period, which is, these are LC headings, in the E's, and then we had field artillery in the UFs, and then, of course, you move on to analytic mechanics, then you have to move to military history, and then you would catalog things under electronic computers and computer science. Then you would move things to electronic apparatus and circuits, computer engineering and hardware, and electronic computers and computer science. In essence, the way in which we categorize these things is not the way we think about these things. What we like to think about is that there is this sort of universal language and way of reducing the world down to categories that we can slot things into, and we can't. Now, it's been terribly effective. I mean, don't let me criticize reductionism too much, because for a couple of centuries it's kept us, you know, got us to the moon. But there are some issues where it's starting to sort of break. As you get more and more resources in this, and you get more and more viewpoints into this, this idea of slotting things into known categories doesn't work so well anymore. Now, let's start our story with the Britons in the 60s. This is a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask. Gordon Pask was a cybernetician, which I think everyone should try and spell. He was in computer science and cybernetics, and at the time, general systems theory dealing with biological systems, but a lot of it was around artificial intelligence. And what he set out to do in the 50s and the 60s and later in the 70s was teach machines how to think. It was the great quest of computer science. And so when he looked around to figure out how he could teach machines to think, he thought he'd start with natural intelligence until artificial intelligence caught up. And so he started looking at how people think and how they learn and how they understand things. And he developed a whole series of systems where what he did was he came up with systems that taught statistics. And he walked people through how those systems work and how they learn. He developed out of this something called conversation theory. And I'm not going to spend too much time on the intricacies of conversation theory, because it's what I read at night to put me to sleep. I've actually read it to my fifth grader, and it works even faster. What he did was he sort of started thinking about how people think, how they really go about learning. And he came around with this concept called conversation theory, and it goes like this. People learn, or his phrase, know, through conversation. When we seek to understand and learn, we do that through conversation, which brings us to why this odd gentleman with the blue tie has been sitting here the whole time, which is, I want to just sort of demonstrate this, and so we're going to start with Bob. That's Bob. I name him after a personal hero of mine, Bob Taylor, but also because I spent much too much time with a professor by the name of Mike Nyland, who also uses Bob as sort of the random user. But that's what Bob is. Bob's a user. Bob's a person. Bob's someone who has a question. And so what we're going to do is we're going to give him his question. That's the little dot in his head. And where did that question come from? Where did that information need come from? Don't worry, we're going from here down to here, but stick with me up here for a second. Where that question came from, what we could call a gap, probably came from a few things. One, it came from what he already knew, and he identified something he didn't know. Right? This is all the stuff I know, but what's this thing? And that need, that desire, that recognition of something he didn't know comes either from, or a combination of, intrinsic motivation. I just want to know. How did that work? How does it happen? Libraries are great at intrinsic motivation. We get a lot of intrinsically motivated people that come to us and they want to know something. That's great. We also know that there's this thing called extrinsic motivation, which means someone makes you want to know something. Right? So the idea of all our school librarians are really used to extrinsically motivated students, which is if I don't find this out, I don't get a good grade. Our academic libraries are filled to the brim with people who want to know exactly how much effort do I have to put in till my extrinsic motivation is satisfied and they get off my back, right? So there's a motivation that goes on and says, I need to know this. Maybe it's a business where I need to put in the financial planning, find me this figure, whatever. So what's going to happen is that Bob needs to understand a domain. He needs to understand some body or field of information, statistics, English lit, how to drywall your house, whatever it is. And that what's going to happen is over time, Bob is going to know more and differently. Right? So Bob is going to embark on this, we can call this learning over time. Now, how is Bob going to do that? Well, Bob's going to engage in conversation. Bob's going to talk to people. Now, I'm going to get a little bit more fine point on that in a second. But Bob talks to a lot of people, including Bob talking to himself, which is not, you know, all the public librarians are going, oh, God, I know Bob now. Pask talks about the idea that we engage in conversation, and the conversation consists of a couple of things. It involves a conversant. Who are you talking with? Now, Pask, once again, cybernetician, guy who doesn't think on an everyday level, if he's willing to use that as a title. And so what he was saying is, sometimes we talk to people. Sometimes we talk to groups of people. Sometimes we're in a group of people talking. Sometimes an organization talks to another organization. If you're negotiating a vendor contract, you're in two parties engaged in a conversation. Very formalized, right? But he also says you can talk to yourself. And you say, what are you talking about? But if you actually thought that, what are you talking about? Who are you asking that question in your head? Right? Now, this may sound a little weird, but we've known for a long time about things called metacognition, or more easily understood as critical thinking skills. We want people to be reflective in how they learn. We do this all the time, right? This morning, well, if I go this way, I get there faster. If I go this way, I get bagels. You're having a debate with yourself, right? It's natural. You can admit it to your friends, all right? So this conversation he's going to engage in a lot. Now, this is really important. People do not have conversations with books. I want to be very clear about this. People have conversations with themselves from reading the books. In other words, if you're reading the book and you're learning, you're thinking about how does this fit in, how do I understand it, how can I do it, the book is there prompting you, but that's not the other conversant in the conversation. Right? And what these conversants are doing is they're sharing language back and forth. Right? Now, language comes from multiple levels. Trust me, I'm really going to end up in the ground, I promise, but enjoy up here in the air for a moment. Language comes at one level of what's called L0, which is very directional. And if you've ever had really bad computer training, you've encountered L0 language. Click here, now click here, now click here. Why? Shut up. Click here, why? No, click here, right? This idea that somehow it's just, how do I do this? Where do I do this? People don't know what they're asking. Reference people are used to this all the time. What do you need to know about? Education. Anything more? No, that's good. If you can teach me all of education, I'll be fine, right? This idea of this L0 language. L1 is when you really have two people talking about a domain. If I say the word catalog here, very few people go, great, JCPenney's. Right? And this notion that you have L1 and L0, systems can accommodate this or not. The world's largest, most powerful, most used L0 system, meaning directional, Google. When people put in education, Google says, fine, drop stuff out. Google doesn't teach people how to ask more sophisticated questions. By the way, a one that is very popular in L0 system, the catalog. Right? If you look at studies of how effective people are in using the catalog, librarians, we rock the catalog. I mean, it's amazing. Really, when people talk, catalogs suck, I hate catalogs. Librarians say that, but the truth is you can run them like crazy. Right? When you're shopping for a catalog, you ask things like, does it do Boolean? Can it do query expansion? What about synonyms and homonyms? Can it increase? Right? The idea is that we're having a really sophisticated L0 conversation. Our users come in, and they want education. System doesn't know what to do with it. Google makes a lot of guesses. What Google says is, hell, I'll give you the most popular thing. That'll probably do it. And often it does, and it does it so fast that people are willing that as they're moving through this process to do lots and lots of queries, whereas the catalog, education is not a term, no results, right? So I just want to think, so they're exchanging language, and what are they doing? They're seeking agreement on something. So what's happening over time here is that Bob's having these conversations. And at each point in these conversations, Bob's coming to an agreement. So what are these little dots, which you can't read? These dots are agreements. What does that mean, an agreement? Well, if you've ever been in a class, you always, and you probably hear me say, does that make sense? Is that right? And you go, or whatever it is, right? The agreement is we can agree on something. We can agree that we're in Massachusetts. We can agree that it's cloudy outside, right? Those are agreements. But we can also make agreements like librarians are good. That's an agreement. Right? That's something that within the field we agree on readily, but outside of the field, interesting conversation. Right? The other thing that that little dot represents besides an agreement is it may include a pointer to some sort of artifact. That's a good book, or I learned this from that book, or this information is contained in that book, the web page. And it involves the conversant. Who did you talk with? Now, what's interesting is cognitive psychology, study after study, will tell you that both the artifact and the conversant will disappear from a person's head much sooner than the agreement will. Right? So we walk around with common knowledge all the time where we say things like, boy, it's hot. Yeah, global warming's happening all the time. Well, global warming, there's a lot of things you probably read that talked about global warming and such, but then could you cite your resource for saying that? A lot of people go, no. Right? It also turns out that it's interesting in that people seek agreements and they sometimes come to what other people might perceive as the wrong agreement. A certain presidential candidate was declared to be a Muslim, for example. And what happens is, when you refute those things, no, he's not a Muslim, no, he's not a Muslim, no, he's not a Muslim, your brain keeps hearing the word, loses the context of who said it and what context it was, and pretty soon it becomes reifying so that more people believe it, even when you're trying to disprove it. Interesting, fun stuff to think about. But the point is that we can map this knowledge out. Now, I want to give you a quick example to say, this is how your brain works, and this is not how our systems work. So let me give you an example of how our brains work. So I'm going to give you a word. There's a word, formula. And I want you to, in your mind, think about what is a formula. What is formula? All right? Got it? This is the interactive portion of our day. How many people thought of a formula as a chemical combination? Couple. All right? How many people thought of it as a mathematical expression? Lots. How many people thought of it as baby food? New mothers, new grandparents, new aunts and uncles. All right. How about now? Now, what's going on in your brain? Your brain looks at formula and has this concept, but it's a really common concept. We've encountered it in lots of different situations, and so we've built all these sort of relations in our brain. So when I say things like mathematical expression, chemical combination, baby food, they may be funny that you didn't think about them, but they're not crazy. Right? You don't sit there and go, what? Right? Because our brain has this connection. I'll give you another one. Light. Light. Okay. Those who thought illumination. All right. Those who thought set a fire. Watch that one. All right. Those who thought not heavy. And what about now? Now, what's interesting is, in 10 years, if I bring that picture into a local high school, what is it? It's not twisty. Yeah. Remember when CFCs used to be things that destroyed the ozone and now it's supposed to save it? Isn't that confusing? All right. All right, one more. OMG. Now, I'm just going to guess. This isn't the interaction. I'm going to guess very few people came up with object management group. The Omnicon media group. I'm going to guess you came up with, oh my God, right? Why? Because how many situations do you encounter that OMG is used? Very few, right? You can guess what picture I'm going to bring up now, right? Or if you're not, it's going to be very unsurprising. Texting, right? It's a strong linkage. In other words, we have that relation in our brain, but we don't have a lot of different relationships for it. We have one, right? So this is how we think. Now, with these agreements, what we can begin to do is combine them. So we can get, what is formula plus light plus, oh my God, right? Fireworks, right? This is not crazy, right? It may be funny, but it makes sense. So this is how we scaffold knowledge back and forth. Now, increasingly, these concepts in our brain are socially derived. Once again, that light bulb picture isn't a matter of we taught someone what a light bulb works. It's how society has shifted and changed and communicated what a light bulb is. So I want to show you the social nature of this effect. If I give you things like buns and books, you all instantly think about that great, great book by Carol Walter on great coffee, cake, sticky buns, and muffins, right? Or women in comfortable shoes. Shame on you if you were not thinking about tennis, right? Nike. And I'll let you add a picture for adult services. You're on your own. My point with all of this is to show you how we think. And as you can probably guess where I'm going, which is if libraries build on how we think and not how we organize stuff, life gets better. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is with your brain, when you're coming to these agreements, when you're thinking about how the world fits together, you don't think in artifacts. And yet, increasingly, we are in a field dominated by artifacts. Some of the statistics I was hearing this morning is how many things do we send out? How many things do we ship around? How many things do people ask for? And what's interesting is when you go to tell the story, my guess is those stories that you're telling to the people you're asking the money for probably don't start with things. Somewhere in there, there's Sally was a so-and-so who then read and heard, and a lot of anecdotes, a lot of interesting stuff, right? Every librarian has the story. That story is that thing that you bring in the back of your mind that makes you proud to be a librarian. It's that time when you change someone's life. It's that time when you have to fix the damn toner cartridge for the third time today and show them where the bathroom is. You pull out that story and go, it's okay. It's okay. I made a difference in the world. Okay? Very few of those stories, in fact, I would guess none of those stories start with, I cataloged this book and I was so happy. Right? Very few of these stories started with, and then the van left the loading dock with a shipment for the other library. Whew! Right? The stories often are about things like the child came in and I found them the perfect book. The mother came in and I showed them the information they had for their ill child. I mean, they can be amazing stories. I've heard amazing stories about domestic abuse and how they linked them to social services that got them out of a bad situation. These stories are profound. And they're the things we hold on to, and almost all of them deal with people and conversations and not things. So here's the thing. This is a page from the Gutenberg Bible. Now, how do we classify it? How do we treat it? Where do we put it? Oh, it's a Bible. That goes here, right? But the truth is we know that because people make these associations, how they think about the Bible, some people may well look at this and say, oh, that's the origin of printing. The Gutenberg Bible is really something testifying to a shift and change in culture. Right? Some people look at this and say, ah, that's an artifact to be preserved. It's a precious object. We need to make sure it doesn't decay. It's stored for future generations. And there's a good amount of people who look at that as religious truth. When they look at the Gutenberg Bible, they see Word of God. Right? Now, the point is that libraries need to be out here and not in here. What we care about is the context of use. So we've had this argument, reference extract, you've heard a little bit about it, we're going to go into more. People talk about librarians picking good sites and bad sites. And I always get up and I make my provocative statements and say, librarians have no special provenance or power in this world to pick good stuff and bad stuff. Librarians have no special ability to pick good books and bad books, good sites and bad sites. And there's, well, yes, I am. Why did I spend all that money for the master's degree? What are you teaching me? What we teach librarians is how to pick good stuff and bad stuff for a given context, for a question, for a user. Absurd example number one. Reporter walks in, wants good websites to talk about hate groups recruiting on the web. Points to Ku Klux Klan website, good job. Eighth grader walks in looking for after school program, not such a good job if we point them to the same resource. Right? We know context matters. So what's also important to know is that the user defines the context, not the object and not the facilitator, not you. This is when we talk about credibility of information. We used to talk about source credibility. If it's in the New York Times, it's credible. We now know that credibility is very much a personal decision. There is a whole group of people out here. If it's in the New York Times, that means it's very suspect. Right? And if it's on Fox News, yeah, right? Did the news change? Did the information change? No, the context changed. So let's go back to Bob. Hello, Bob. And we know that what happens, what is the result of this is how people think? If this is how people search for, understand, and gain knowledge, and libraries are in the knowledge business, what impact does that have upon what we do? Not in the thing business, not in the warehousing business, not in the indexing and abstracting business, but in the knowledge business, how does this change our world? Well, the first thing this does is it creates what I call a pressure for participation. People want to be active constructors of their knowledge. Right? You've all had the bad classroom experience where you've fallen asleep and you walk out and people say, well, they came to the class. They learned. No, they didn't. They doodled. They didn't pay attention. They did their email. All these horrible things. It takes two to learn. It takes two to have that conversation, and therefore they must be active constructors of the knowledge. They want tools that then facilitate that. So when they walk up to our catalogs, or they walk up to our reference desks, or they walk into our collections, how much are we facilitating knowledge and letting them participate in it? Right? How much, why is it that people go to Wikipedia versus other systems? We'll get that in a second. All right. So what I want to talk about now is, where are they doing this? Well, we know they're doing it in at least three different environments. We know that they are, that Bob here is working in a digital environment, a physical environment, and a hybrid environment. What's a hybrid environment? I had to go to the library to search the online database. Example. All right? So what this pressure for participation is doing is changing how we think about systems, digital systems, to do this. So really quickly, what we're seeing is an evolution of how we design systems in this world. We really take 3 points. There's a system view, which is the classic old style view. This is, we go ask the expert and we build the system that the expert says we should build. There is a user-based design, which means we go ask users, find out what the user requirements are, and build the system based on it. And increasingly, we're moving into the world of a user system where we literally give them this blank slate with a few tools and let them build it around themselves. All right? So in the first case, we have an expert-driven systems, the people who know, librarians building catalogs. Right? We have user-based, user-derived systems. We go do focus groups of our patrons, our members, and we design our websites around what they say. And now we're talking about user-built systems. They go to Flickr and create their world. They go to Facebook. They go to MySpace. The first one is loaded with deep functionality. It does a lot, as do user-based systems. But user systems are very much loaded with shallow functionality. Look at Flickr. Look at Facebook. Look at MySpace. The tools they're giving you are really itsy-bitsy. I can upload a picture. I can tag a picture. That's, I mean, minuscule functionality. But what people have been doing with tagging and photos is amazing, the variety and the complexity they can build from simple groups. System views tend to be modal, means you do step one, you do step two, you do step three. User-based systems tend to be non-modal, like interfaces where I can click and pick the tool I want. And user systems tend to be highly customizable, which you can do either you want. System views target a user. User-based systems talk about collaboration. Email is an example of a user-based system. Social user systems are social, meaning I actually work in the group in public. Integrated library systems is an example. Operating systems is an example. And Web 2.0 is an example. Now, what's interesting is, I remember I said users want tools that allow them to participate. This is relatively old data, but it talks about, this is GeoCities, which was a Yahoo build your own homepage site. This is MySpace. What's going on here? GeoCities, you go to pick from their templates, you walk through their interface design, they tell you what you can upload or can't. MySpace says, you want it ugly? Make it ugly. If this is the place you want to keep your beer bong collection pictures, go ahead! Right? Good luck on that job interview. But anyway. People move to where they can control their environments, where they can become a participant. Same thing in the encyclopedia world. This is Encarta versus Wikipedia. Why? Well, one's free, one's not. Nope, Encarta was free. Well, one takes more letters to type? Nope. Well, one's just good enough. What does just good enough mean? Good enough means it was good enough, right? What happens is, as people came in, this became more relevant to their life because they could see themselves reflected in it, the topics they cared about. Encarta wasn't doing too many articles on steampunk mod cases of computers, right? Because that wasn't authentic enough. But in Wikipedia, if it wasn't there, I could add it. I could participate. This was a system I understood, that as I'm navigating and going through knowledge, I can make it reflect my knowledge, not try and figure out someone else's scheme of the world. All right? So back to Bob, because your obvious question is, Dave, that's great in a digital environment. That clearly means you've forgotten this thing called, one, the library, ba-doing, which is what do we do in the library, and two, there's this whole little thing we call, well, let's physical spaces, but we'll get to that in a second. So let me show you some tools that are designed around this concept. We're going to start with one called Scapes, and it's how to do reference in a virtual environment. Because if you look at our reference systems now, they're built on the old model. Question Point and what have you are reference desks online. We ask people to leave what they're doing, come into our spaces, use our tools, of which we have better interfaces than they do, get their information, and then make it their job to integrate it into their own environment. And what I wanted to, we started thinking about is, what does reference online look like in this kind of environment? And so we designed a new reference interface. Here it is. All right, I'm kidding. There it is. The metaphor with Scapes is, imagine someone comes in with a question, the first thing you do is you sit them down at a table. And it's their table. And what they begin doing is they're collecting resources, thinking, taking notes, as they begin making piles on the table. And then what happens is if they get stuck, they can invite someone in to help them with that. A librarian, a friend, a professor, a whomever, and they work collaboratively on this environment. So I'm going to say I'm driving down the street and I listen to this song by Gwen Stefani, and I called Rich Girl, and it's bugging me because I think I've heard it before, but not the same. So I go and do a search in this online environment. Here's my search. And I find Rich Girl, and I drag that into my environment. And you're not going to be able to hear it, but it's getting down, getting funky. Okay. Promised my wife I'd never dance in public again. Now, so I have this song, and I drag it into my space. Now, what can I do? Well, with typical sort of library metadata, I can find out things like who the artist was, what the album was, what the release date, and I can build a relationship that this song was from this album. Ooh-ah, ooh-ah, ooh-ah. That's not answering my question. So what I'm going to do is invite a friend in. I'm going to use my library lifeline, call a friend, and I'm going to bring in Jeff Penka, because I like picking on him. And up pops this chat environment simultaneously, and I say, hey, Jeff, do you know where I can find the lyrics to this song? And so Jeff says, hold on, and he goes and does a search with the same tools that I can see at the same time, not hold on while I search for this information. Look, I'm brilliant, right? This is the way librarians do it, the black box. And he says, you know, I found someone else had done a scape around the lyrics of this song, and I'm going to drag that in. And so, sure enough, he adds it. And if I look at it, it's the lyrics of the song, Ooh-Ah. But it's not just a document. It's how that document relates to all this other stuff. So someone has gone in, and they've taken four lyrics, lines out of the song, and expanded on them. So, for example, In My Galliano Gown, or my favorite, I Get Me Four Hayuka Girls to Uh-Huh. And now what they've done is they've actually said, the Hayuka girls are, in fact, Stefani's backup dancers, and they're named after this fashionable subway stop in Tokyo, and here's a Wikipedia entry on it. Now, you're not going to pick that up from a classification. No one is going to catalog Wikipedia for when Dave is looking for, right? It's not going to happen, but I'm being able to create this trail through it. And that still doesn't do it for me, because I want to hear if it's a remake, and so I go back, and now I'm going to bring in a librarian, because we know they know everything, and I'm going to say, hey, I know I've heard this song. Have you heard it? The librarian's going to say, actually, it's a remake of Fiddler on the Roof. I'm going to go ahead and add in all that information, and using some simple tools available to everyone at the table, they go ahead and add in that this is, in fact, a version of If I Were a Rich Man from Fiddler on the Roof. Here are the song lists for Fiddler on the Roof. And so I've created this connection. All right? And now we're all happy, so we all sign off. But I could leave this as a public environment that other people could find. Or Jeff's driving home that night, and comes back in, and he says, you know what? I just heard another song she did as a remake. And he goes ahead and adds that information, which is Wind It Up. And in case you're wondering, right? Really, the Julie Andrews of our era. And there's not enough yodeling on top 40 music, damn it. The other thing we can do is once we have systems that allow people to represent their knowledge like this, they come to the library, they can build these scapes, is we can extract that information up and we can build things like search engines out of it. So some of you may have heard a little bit about a system we are building or planning called Reference Extract. This is what Reference Extract is. If you look at Google, Google does it by page, what's called PageRank. What they do is they assume that pages that are pointed to the most are most important. Now, people say that's popular. Some people say, but it turns out it's remarkably good. I mean, it's amazing how much popularity handles things like relevance and things of that nature, particularly when people are putting in education, click, right? Now, what we thought is, how could we use this kind of innovation, but in a library context where we have this rich conversation and expertise going? We looked specifically about credibility. This is a study, the InterConnect study out of North Carolina, where what they did was they asked a bunch of populations, so about 1,700 people, what sites do you find most credible? So they asked about library sites, museum sites, archive sites, genealogical sites, government websites, commercial websites, and individual websites. And the outstanding leader of this was that people found library websites to be the most credible resources on the net. Okay? So what if we, instead of taking this random page ranking, if we looked at all these reference interviews and we gathered the information of what sites are being pointed to most by you, by people who know about good information and context and do this in a setting, could we grab this data and do ranking not based on popularity, but by reference citedness? And in fact, we took some of our preliminary tests are we took these sites. By the way, number one most cited resources in Oregon of all last year in their virtual reference service? Wikipedia. Number three resource in Question Point worldwide? Wikipedia. So stop it. Oh, I'm sorry. So what we did is we took the most cited sources. We used Google's Roll Your Own search engine, which uses all of Google's algorithm, everything the same, but it's just limited to the sites that librarians picked. And we then gave them to experts and said, how credible are these sites? We didn't say, these are librarian pick sites, these are open Google. We just said, here's sites, which ones do you find more credible? This blue line is open Google. This red line is sites selected by reference librarians. What it meant was people found things selected by reference librarians more credible than open Google, even without knowing there were reference librarians pointing to it. Okay? So how can we take that and build in a search engine that looks something, you know, this is a guess. You know, these are the top cited things by reference librarians. Then you can even dig in and say, well, which reference librarians? Because we know Multnomah County Public Library did focus groups with teenagers, asked them what they wanted, and the teenager says, we want your librarians to blog. And the librarians all looked at them like they were insane. Do you really want to hear about, you know, Mark? Do you really want... They said, no, we want to hear what you're reading, because we want reader's advisory. But we don't want just a list. We want to know who you are to find out if we like you. And if we like you, we'll read the things you're reading. So don't give us readers' advisories lists. Give us blog postings, because I want to know if you're cool. And it works the other way, too. And when I was in a doctoral program, Mary McKenna was the person, a fellow doctoral student, I'd always go to and say, what good movie should I go see? And whatever she said, I knew I would hate it. And it was amazing. You've never found someone just diametrically opposed to your taste in movies, because she could do the same thing with me. Because I like crap movies where things blow up, and she likes, you know, complicated films. But, you know. So we can build these kind of relationships. Now, what's interesting is when we put out a press release saying that we were going to plan for this, a lot of people have picked it up. I was quoted in the New York Times. I forwarded it off to my mom. You know, it was cool. The Huffington Post picked it up. And the Huffington Post said, first of all, I love, you can't see it, but this little picture is a librarian looking at books with books on their head. All right? And this was one of the comments. And I want to read the comment because I think it talks a lot about how people's understanding of what we do needs to change. Now, that is an interesting idea. Quality instead of quantity. Of course, we have to ask ourselves, what took librarians 10 years to realize that? I do note that being a librarian is a kind of slow profession, but still, it's not like we couldn't have collected high quality links a long time ago. Now, what I love about this quote is that, one, it pisses me off. And whenever I get pissed off is when I do my best work. It really is. And it should piss you off, too. Right? But it says a couple of things. One, who are we engaging in conversation and what are they getting out of those conversations? And I want to know, it's not like we haven't been collecting good links for 10 years. How many people on your website have this is the good stuff, right? The pointers, the references. So we need to talk about how we have a larger societal conversation on this. So I'll just leave that one. Now, So we talked about how we can build systems and what they might look like, library systems, based on how people think, not on the stuff we have. Now let's talk about our physical environments, because we know people are coming more and more to our physical environments. And this is some of the work we did in Philadelphia Free Library, where they're talking about what should we do with our physical environments. Comfy reading rooms, fine. But what we did is we started talking to a bunch of people. So we talked to business people in Philadelphia area, and we said, what do you want in a public library? And the business people said, we don't care what's in the public library. We don't go there. Right? I'm a special, you know, maybe I take my kid there for reading hour, but in my day, we have a library. Or we have some other resources. But almost to a person, they then turned around and said, but when I was first starting out, the public library was the most important thing I could have found. When I was, in essence, at my current job and researching my next job, public library. When I was building a new business, public library. Right? And so we started saying, well, what was that moment like? And they said, well, the thing is, first thing you gotta do is you gotta build a business plan. I didn't know what a business plan was, they said. So I went to the library, they handed me a book on business plans. I couldn't even understand the book. What I really want is a curriculum that takes me through the necessary steps to become a business person. And so these topical centers became a place that you could go, and instead of just saying, here's stuff, it would walk them through a process to the next resource. Right? They wanted field trips to successful businesses. They wanted mentorship opportunities. They wanted a daycare for their kids so they could start the business because they couldn't do it while that kid was all around. And that may lead to other topical centers. So we talked, for example, at Philly Free about a business center. We called it the Entrepreneurium. We talked about music center. We talked about writing center. We talked about teen centers. We talked about aged centers. We didn't call it aged centers, but active older American centers. I know. As I become an active older American, I roll my eyes less and less at that. But so the idea here is that instead of this library, the business collection looking like this, what we were told was the business collection needs to look like this. FedEx Kinko's, we need a place to work, we need a business center, we need basic instruction, we need mentorship opportunities. Instead of the music center, when we talked to musicians looking like where they could find music, what they really said is, you know what, we can find music. And don't worry about pop music, because that seems handled. We talked about, you know, matchmaking opportunities. You had a bassist and a guitarist, get them together. They said, that happens in the clubs, and it's never going to happen here. So what you really need to worry about is world music and classical music. And the idea is, in classical music, well, in popular music, we talk about how the publishing system is in danger. You know, all this piracy is going to put them out of business. In the classical music area, it's gone. You cannot make a living as a composer anymore. You're like, sell insurance and do composing on the side. But the problem is there was no place for these folks to perform. What they'd do is they would walk in and they'd find this music, but they would have to hum it to themselves. And then the other thing they would have to do is they really needed a place to play the music. They were perfectly willing to give you the score for the collection, to record the music for that collection and make it part of your collection, to do introductory lectures about it. But what they wanted to do was play, because that was how they did their job. What they wanted were two grand pianos on a stage. Now, what was remarkable about this was they said, this made you sort of suddenly think, how much of your library reflects your community and how much of your library reflects the consumption of your community? What do I mean? Think about an academic library. All my academic libraries, shout out. The idea is when someone doesn't have the resource in their office, they come to the library and say, buy it. Over time, what that means is your collection looks like all the things that your faculty didn't have. And as they're able to get more and more of that without coming to you, what does that do with this collection of stuff you didn't have? Now, that's a lot of the reason we moved to ideas of repositories, digital repositories, where we collect their materials, right? Yes, but if we just put them in these nice little Dublin Core wrappers and hope that people will browse them, we miss completely the way that academics think about their papers. They're part of conversations, scholarly conversations. Why do we spend so much time on the front part of the book with the title and the author and the copyright when all the really cool stuff is in the back of the book through citations? That's what scholarly communication is about. All right, but I digress. So anyway, so we end up with this environment. All right? And so what I want to show you then is if we go back to Bob here. Hey, Bob. Is I want to walk you through answering my beginning question. So, we began with Pask sets out to figure out how to teach machines how to learn. In doing so, he develops conversation theory that says people learn through conversation, and that conversations then create a pressure to participate. This pressure to participate is amplified by technology. If libraries are in the knowledge business, they're in the conversation business. These users now can organize their own schemes. The schemes are an authorship or creation process. The library must facilitate that creation process. And knowledge creation in the music area means making music, which is why you end up putting two grand pianos in a library. See, didn't think I could do it. All right. What I want to say, the outcome of this, is the mission of the library must be to facilitate the knowledge creation of its community through conversation, not through more stuff. A huge amount of our profession and our education system is geared towards artifacts and access. The idea that the way we enrich a community is we provide access to information. Access is insufficient for facilitation, is very insufficient for knowledge. It's like walking a 5-year-old into your stacks and saying, learn how to read, and walking away. Right? Throw them in the water, see if they swim. Well, they drowned. Oh, well. Right? This idea that somehow by pointing them to the book and believing that somehow we've had an impact in their life is insufficient. You need to be able to access the conversation. You need to know what's going on in the conversation. Here's the perfect book for you. It's in Mandarin. Do you read Mandarin? No? Oh, well. Right? They need the knowledge of how to do it. They need a safe environment in which they can do it. No one's looking over your shoulder, intellectual freedom, and they need to a motivation to do it and for us to understand their motivation. When an undergraduate walks in or when a ninth grader walks in and says, I need this document because my teacher told me I need this document, this is not a teachable moment. This is not a teachable moment. Try as you will. The only thing you're going to be able to help that person do is do it faster. It's like ripping the bandage off. What we need to recognize is when is it a teachable moment? When is it intrinsically motivated? Or what motivates them so when they walk in with this, we can say, you know, this is just like your other thing. And now we got them. But if you just do, here's the thing, you don't get them. Where am I going with this? What I want to say is, in this world, libraries are perfectly situated to thrive. Libraries, first of all, function as authorities, not as authoritarians. Stop talking about the libraries where you go to get the good stuff and the internet's all the rest of the stuff. Because we know good stuff is not our determination, it's theirs. And what makes people trust, why that line shoots to the top, is because people know that when they walk into a library, they have a professional who listens to their needs and serves their needs. That makes us authorities, not authoritarian, where this is the good stuff. You must know this. You will learn that. Right? This is what schools do. Let them do it. We will take the other part of real learning. Enjoy it. Right? We're honest brokers and we facilitate community conversations. We are tool builders. A lot of times when I show these tools and people are like, well, can I download it? I'm like, no, we got to build it. They're like, oh. That somehow technology is foreign to us. I will tell you that a librarian can go toe-to-toe with any tech, weedy, geek, nerd on three-letter acronyms. If you ever want to feel like a techie, that's all it is. So when a techie comes to you and says, I'm sorry, we can't do that because the Apache server's down because we had to go through the firewall. We had a problem going through the firewall, but we had to get through the LDAP system because if we didn't get through the LDAP system, we weren't going to be able to disambiguate the identities in the directory server. Just look at them and go, well, once you get that figured out, I have a problem with a MARC record that has to go through ILL because the ILL's request came through a system where we have a CERC, and CERC's going to go into... You can do it. Blow them out of the water. Right? You think Java's tough? Ha! Look at MARC. Right? Java makes sense. It does something. Mark, what the hell? We just added numbers. Right? You know, look at a Perl manual. Think it's complicated? Read anything by Forrest Press. Right? We're tool builders. And what we need to do as librarians is stop riding these waves and become the wave machine. We need to stop thinking about, well, oh, Google's doing this, and oh, Twitter's doing this, and oh, Facebook is doing this. We must be there. We must run. We must get a wiki. Enjoy. But why? Why and why not? I think blogging is awesome when you talk about teens wanting readers advisory services. I think another person blogging about changing the toner cartridge will bring not one more user into your library and frankly doesn't benefit the conversation of us all. Why? Why not? And without a deeper understanding of why we're doing this, what we call participatory librarianship, which is based on this conversation theory, you don't know what to do next. What's important and what's not important? Play. I think play is vitally important, but play must be finished at some point. What's your process for play? What's your process for having your librarians explore? And what's the process to move from play to implementation? Think about this. Think about the idea of what is it, how are you going to answer the why question if you don't, if you think you're in the thing business, you'll never be able to answer the why blog, why wiki. It doesn't make sense. Two different worlds. Why is it when we build catalogs, over here we do the wonderful 3D, what's the graphical browser thing? Aqua browser, over here, and over here we put facets. And we go, oh, look, they're cool, they're graphic, they're user-friendly, they're participatory, we've done it. This system does OR searching, so it's just an exploration system. As you click through it, you find new and more different stuff. These facets over here are a drill-down system. It's an AND system. It takes you to narrower. Do you think the users have any clue that those are different things? And yet we present those interfaces to them as if they are self-explanatory because they're graphical. Have you looked at Microsoft Word recently? Turn on every toolbar they have. You have this much room to type. And then play the game with your friends of identify the icon and what the hell it means in real life. Just because it's a picture doesn't make it intuitive. Right? We need to provide the connective tissue to our organizations. The stories that we need to be able to tell are not, we have this usage data over here, and we have these anecdotes about Sally over here. We need to say, we improved the conversation of economic development in my city. The reason I know that is because I can map the conversation, I can map every utilization of the resource to it, and I can talk about what actions came out. I can evaluate it to an nth degree. Academic libraries, when you come up for accreditation, here are the standards you will no longer be asked about. What is your collection size, and what are your operating hours? The question you'll be asked about is, how did you help your freshmen get this core knowledge? What is the core knowledge? How are your services fit into that outcome assessment? Special librarians, you already know this, because if it doesn't enhance the bottom line, why are you there? Right? So we need to provide these connective tissues. We must be prepared. Librarians must be radical change agents. Because here's the hidden trick. If you're in the knowledge business, if you're in the growth of knowledge business, you are in the change business. Knowledge does not mean something that gets dropped like a brick into empty buckets. It is a process of change. It is a process of changing the society, and it has a definition of better and worse. And when you're part of that process, you cannot be neutral. It is impossible to be unbiased. That thing should be struck out of every document we have. It is impossible to be unbiased. It is possible to be intellectually honest. So when someone asks you a question at the reference desk and you either start doing this or you start doing this, you have shown a bias. When you point someone to one publisher over another, you have shown a bias. When you rank results, even if they're by algorithm about something really stupid like last in, first out, you have shown a bias. If you look at the Dewey Decimal Classification System, it is rife with bias. Look for any obscure Christian text, and then look for any obscure Muslim text, and the numbers will look like this for the Christian text, and this for the Muslim text. Why? Well, I don't know. Maybe Dewey had a bias when he put it together. I mean, after all, God did give him the 10 classes in a church. Look it up. All right. Now, as a bearded professor from upstate New York, I can't talk too much about my friend, but still. Right? We need to think that if we are in the change business and knowledge business, that means everything we do is about change and knowledge and making something better. And we must be radical in that. We can no longer hide behind our collections, and we can no longer be loved to death. We must fix our innovation economy. I'm not going to spend too much time there because I'm over time. The future is everyone's business. Gratitude never radicalized anybody. Don't be loved to death. What do I mean? You're a librarian, you know exactly what I mean, which is, if you, anyone asks, what do? You say, I'm a librarian. You go, oh, so cool. You must be good at crossword puzzles. Do you like the library? I love the library. Books and that musty smell of decaying and their wood and the scent. No, I love it. Do you ever go? No. Don't be loved to death. What that means is to be loved means someone's willing to get up and be loyal and fight for and discuss and argue and be part of. And what I love, once again, from this morning, these hard economic times are actually a great opportunity to build those strong relationships. Right? It's not enough to be liked. It's not enough to be loved. We need to be used. And what's even more, we need to have a positive impact in the world. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Ladies and gentlemen, this is our calling as librarians. It's not to organize stuff. And it's not even an organization. It's change and improvement of society. Our field is a noble field. We don't have jobs, we have vocations. Our mission is not to inform, our mission is to improve. Our mission is not simply to observe and document society, but to make it better. And every day we must look at this and say, thank God I'm a librarian. Thank God I have this opportunity. And you must be engaged on a regular basis to walk into every department and tell them why they need you and prove it every day. Thank you very much. The slides will be here, so you can actually read them in the back. Sorry about that. I think we have a few minutes for questions or comments or... Yeah, right. Yes, sir.
The Scape product, is that something you're working on currently? Is that a tool that is out there now and available?
The Scape product is not a product. The Scape product is a bunch of PowerPoint slides. But it's one that we have proposals in, it's one that we have specifications for, and it's one that we're very interested in actively finding the resources to develop. But it's one that we're also looking at partners to help us pursue and develop that as well. Reference Extract, which is the search side, which frankly should come after Scapes, but MacArthur liked search engines, and you're going to say no to the money. That one we need, we're in the planning process, and we need to talk specifically about how that can be a product of the library community and not Dave in Syracuse, and really look at partnerships from consortia and group, talk about how we can share reference answers and questions, how this can benefit us all. So that's one that's real specific. Hopefully that will start being built in January. I'm sorry? Yes. The innovation economy really that I jumped over really quickly is this. Right now, a lot of the system, libraries by and large are consumers of technology. We buy our integrated library systems, we buy these different systems, and what's interesting is it's really switched our model. We used to own collections, now we lease them. I mean, there's lots of that. The problem we have right now in the systems that we buy is the business model for the vendors, even open source folks, is that they want to capture all new innovation. So if you want to add tagging or visualization, they want to be, in essence, able to charge you on top of. That has a couple of problems. I mean, this is not a vendor bash. I mean, I understand why they do it. The big problem is they're not going to be able to keep up. With mashups and all these kinds of things, they can't assume that everyone sitting in Berkeley or wherever they are has the ability to capture the web and the whole new innovation ideas. So what I think the model that benefits both is to talk about how they can build minimal functionality with lots of APIs so that you can develop the cool thing. I can take my books and map them against Google Map. They can then look at this and say, it's like my iPhone, right? So, you know, gadget of the day. Apple revolution recently was the App Store. It used to be that cell phone vendors gave you a closed system and said, if you want music, if you want a new application, you pay us to do it. What Apple did was said, no, we're going to be a marketplace. Here's the basic thing. We're going to give a store. We take a skim off the top because we provide the store, but then it provides this economy where everyone gets the benefit from new innovation. So if you develop a cool new addition to the integrated library system, they become your marketer because you don't want to be in that business. They take money for being your marketer, and then the money for actual implementation goes back to you for the next innovation. That, I think, is a new shifty model we need to talk about from vendors and onward. And I think that we really need to look at how, right, the first integrated library systems and catalogs came out of a consortia of libraries who said we need to build these things. I think it's time for us to look at a network of, say, the next set of tools, we need to build these things, and we're not going to wait for someone else to sell it to us. Fair enough? Other comments, questions? Anyone want to mint? Yeah. No, what I'm much more interested is open operability, right? So with Google, when you put Google Maps, you don't get the source code to Google Maps, but you get the map, right? When you put an API into Amazon that sends you back a book from an ISBN number, you don't get the database and system they use to do it, but you still get that back. So the notion of being able to, one of the things, people often say that Dave is in favor of destroying the catalog, and that's not true. I want to shelter it and keep it away from our users because they can get hurt. The catalog is just another database of resources, just like a database of full text resources. We need to build this integrative layer that when you search across, right, federated searching stuff. And so when I look at the idea that III and all these folks are coming out with Encore and Aqua Browser, right, that's where they're going, but as long as it's still within the closed box, right, I look at things like Library Thing. I look at things like Shelf Safari. I look at these. The people looked at libraries and said, I love my library. I hate your systems. I'm going to build something that's better for me. It turns out better for a lot of people. We should go, yay! Right? And we'll provide you the data for it because everyone should be able to build those interfaces and such, and we should make it easy to do it. And that doesn't mean, you know, my issue with open source catalogs is that they're open source, which is great, but they're busy replicating the dinosaurs. So they're open source dinosaurs. Right? This notion that we're artifact-centric, that when you find a book and you don't know how that book is in any way related to the rest of the universe, even if it's in a series, sometimes we don't capture that information. Right? But when you do people who like this book also might like this book, that's escape, right? It's a relationship between... Go into Amazon and look at the comments that are on Amazon. I did a little quick thumb. Anywhere between 50 and 70% of the comments on a book have nothing to do with the book. They're relating the book to everything else. I can't believe Amazon offered these two books as a deal when these two things totally oppose. Or the Twilight series that's really big now, go read the Twilight comments because they're all like, well, the second book wasn't as good as the first book. Or the third book, I couldn't wait for the third book because they're talking about the series, but because Amazon deals with things, they have to force that conversation into that book. We do the same thing, we just don't let them talk about it at the same time. So we need to talk about knowledge, understanding the world is how things relate, not that what things are. And so that's what we need to start building systems to talk about how we relate the world's knowledge to conversation, not conversations. Oh, we'll mark record them and we'll put them in the catalog. That's not the point.
Do you recommend any implementation preliminary of these ideas?
Can I recommend any implementations of these systems? Google. Yeah, I know. But actually, think about Google for a second, because you can do Google mapping, you can bring it in. Google, even though it's only popularity, it represents a relationship of these things. I think there are a lot of good federated searching options out there that can be looked at. I think that the Encore products and the Aqua browsers are a step in the right direction, but they're not quite there yet. And the answer is, unfortunately, I can't point to too many implementations because I think we need to build them. Where you're seeing some of this is in the social network world, Facebook's and MySpace and such, but they don't quite get it either. they're building and succeeding, but they think it's because people want to go and be seen. But it's not about being seen in vanity. It's about shaping the universe around you. And I think that our attempts to come up with the My Libraries and the library portal interfaces did not work, because what we were trying to do is have them arrange how they look at the library, when what they want to do is see how they do the world. Pentags is actually a really great library-like example. When the University of Pennsylvania went to create systems where they could annotate and build tags, they didn't build it in the catalog. They built a different system, because then you could relate catalog items to full text items to web resources to whatever you wanted. I think Pentags is actually an excellent implementation along these lines.
You're welcome.
All right, I know I'm keeping you from your next meeting. The people are looking forward to the cozy warm one downstairs. So, thank you again very much. This will be on the web if you need it.